that means we'll have less crime, less victims, less, you know, problems in our communities, etc. I mean, we have a lot of, you know, the tough on crime people have, in theory, at least, you know, they at least will say they have the same goals. But to say that we're not invested in trying to make our community safer is wildly inaccurate.
Well, let's talk about the tough on crime people for a moment. Another section of your piece: normalizing militarized police is dangerous for Americans. There is a school of thought that if we just threaten people with worse and worse punishments, if we just threaten people and basically like an animal, stand up real big and puff ourselves out and roar, growl a little louder, that everything will be, that people will stop committing crimes. You know, it's like parents, just keep threatening your kid with being grounded, threatening your kid with a cutting off this and that, threatening. And that's why when parent, that's, I mean, I never raised kids, but I was a kid, and that didn't work for me, and that didn't work on anyone I knew, right? But
doesn't work. The data doesn't bear it out either. You know, I mean, basically with the subject of deterrence, what there is a, you can see in the research on deterrence that if you have a certainty of punishment, there is a somewhat robust deterrent effect. I'm not saying it's a massive, it doesn't stop crime in its, but there is an effect from the certainty of punishment. There is not, however, any such effect from the degree of punishment. In other words, severe punishment doesn't make crime go down any more than anything else. Certainty of punishment might, because it's not like 60% falls off the thing. And part of that's because what causes crime has very little to do with punishment, right? Like, you don't start going to the store to rob something because someone threatened to punish you or not to punish you. You go because you don't have the money to buy food. You know, I mean, there are probably exceptions to that. I'm not saying that's 100% of the time. But, you know, they're, you know, for a large amount of people who are, you know, trying to steal food, the reason is because they're hungry, you know, and if you're not addressing that problem, you're not really solving that crime. And on top of that, there's also another misnomer that people have, is that, like, somehow everyone who is committing crimes has memorized the criminal code. You know, I mean, like, they sit around and they know, like, oh, well, that might violate 353.267.8, which means I'd get an enhancement or whatever. You know, they don't have like a working memory of the, you know, maybe some do, but, you know, I don't think most people who are committing crimes in a moment of passion, like a violent crime is usually a moment of passion, that you all of a sudden go, hold on, I have this personal issue with this other person and we're getting in a fight right now. I'm going to stop that because there's a obscure part of the code that says if I do it this way, I'll get an enhancement, and that means I'll do more time, which means I should, you know, stop right now. I mean, that's probably not the way it works in most cases. At least that hasn't been my experience in areas where I've seen crimes happen or been around crimes. But there's a second level, which I think is really important too. I'm sorry to jump around a little bit, but the second level is, it's not just a question of, like, the reason why policy is important is it teaches us how to better address crime. So if we're really can, you know, if we're in an area that really needs some work on trying to reduce crime, there's a lot of things we could try to do, and several things that have worked, like violence interruption, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, having more people in the civil service, you know, there's all kinds of things that have been tried and have worked that you could apply perhaps. That's different than sending in the military. And there's another level beyond the crime reduction thing that is a problem of applying the military to something that's not a military problem. And that's the reason why the founders and, you know, especially if this, you know, and a lot of other people over time have tried to put firewalls between the military and domestic enforcement. And the reason for that is because that's the bluntest of instruments, and they have no expertise in this area. And they do, even by their presence, have a, effect on the liberty of the people in the area that they're surveilling or that they're enforcing. So, like, if I'm walking around in DC and there are, you know, military people with rifles all over the place, and I'm being surveilled 24/7 by drones and cameras everywhere and things like that, that has an effect on my freedom and my liberty. And at some level, this experiment that we're all a part of has something to do with preserving liberty. at least in theory, right? So like the idea is, what are you going to sacrifice your liberty for? I would rather put investments in things that don't sacrifice my liberty and reduce crime than things that reduce my liberty and probably don't decrease crime. That's kind of the point I was making. I think we should hold our liberty more preciously than people seem to think is important. I don't want the military all over the country, and I just don't think that's a good idea for any number of reasons.
This is my conversation with Josh Ho, Senior Policy Manager at Dream.org. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. KBOO Community Radio has spent more than half a century serving the Pacific Northwest with trusted news, life-saving information, inspiring music, and deep community engagement. All made possible not by corporate influence, but by tens of thousands of individual donors, foundations, and sponsors across the states who believe in independent, non-commercial media. Now more than ever, we turn to our community to keep the mission alive and help us supplement the $110,000 we are losing in federal funding due to Congress's vote to cut federal grants for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Please go to kboo.fm/give and help independent community media cover the gap. Thanks! Now let's get back to my conversation with Josh Ho, Senior Policy Manager at Dream.org. Go back to a moment. You mentioned the certainty of being caught in punishment, the certainty rather than the severity. And when that I do data, and one of the data points that I always love to talk about is the clearance rate, which you take the number of known criminal offenses, the property crimes, the violent crimes, and then you determine how many of those were cleared by basically an arrest or an indictment. It doesn't mean that anybody was ever found guilty. It just means that the authorities found someone to pin the blame on. I mean, they don't prevent crime. And the problem of solving crime, you have less than 20% of all property offenses that are known to the authorities, that are reported crimes, less than 20%, more like about 15 or 14% are ever cleared with some kind of an arrest or an indictment. With violent crimes, it's under 50%. And again, these are only the reported crimes. So those crimes that go unreported, and there are large numbers of crimes that go unreported, the criminal victimization surveys, which is one of the other really important bits of data that the Bureau of Justice Statistics works on, show that there are loads of crimes, great proportion of them, that are never reported. So that police rarely solve as it is, which is that, you know, because we have this ridiculous notion of an occupying army instead of, working with a community and trying to make things better. And that's not a question. I just wanted to bring that up. But it plays back into the point that crime statistics are important and they do show us something. And I think if we look at the fact that police don't really do a good job of, solving crimes, let alone preventing them, that it would, I think, move people toward toward the notion that we need to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, two little pieces of thing here. The first one is, you're right that, like, everyone always says, well, who are you going to call when you've been robbed? Well, that's true. You're probably going to call the police, but the robbery's already happened. You know, they don't prevent that from happening. They respond to it happening. And so I think you're right there. The only thing, from my position, I obviously am more on your side than the other, but I probably should at least mention that there is pretty good data that suggests that when police are present in a particular place at a particular time, that they deter crime. In other words, if you see a police officer, you're probably not going to try to shoot somebody right in front of the police officer or rob them or whatever it is. Maybe you still will, but the likelihood is less when they're in a particular place in a particular time. And the problem with that is that if you extend that out, that means that you put police in every particular place at every particular time. And that's my point about liberty. If there's other ways that we can reduce crime that don't require police in every single place and every single time and us being surveilled 24/7, I would prefer we did that. And on top of that, I was just going to say, I don't know even that would cause us to solve crime in the way that, sometimes Trump seems to suggest, that somehow crime will just stop, You know, I mean, that the reasons why crime happen have a lot to do with places, to conditions and people and situations that aren't solved by massive deterrents.
If you're someone who, you know, physically looks like one of the usual suspects, and I don't mean characters from that particular movie, I mean the kind of person who is consistently being harassed by police and is always being brought in, always being questioned, whether they're doing anything or not. They're just, you know, maybe they're unhoused, maybe they're just poorly dressed, they might be and probably are a Black, Indigenous, or other person of color. There could be any number of reasons why they're being harassed, and what you end up doing with that extra police presence is you discourage people from being in public spaces. You discourage people from going out. I mean, if you want to stop people from going to a syringe exchange, then you just put cops there on the corner. And that has actually been, that we have research to show that, that by increasing the police presence around a syringe exchange, people are less likely to frequent that syringe exchange, which means more people will get HIV, more people will get hepatitis C, people will have wounds going untreated, and oh yes, there will be more needle litter. There's a lot of reasons for syringe exchange, a lot of reasons for harm reduction programs, and that's one of the things that police presence, stops.
And we're seeing that happen in DC right now. One of the things that I didn't mention that I think is really bad about this whole federalization is part of the point of the federalization is to, in essence, take all the people who are unhoused in the DC area and either move them to facilities, which we can discuss, or to incarceration. You know, and this is part of a outgrowth of the Supreme Court case of Grants Pass, which happened last year, which in essence allows states and localities to move unhoused people to camps or whatever outside of the main areas of where people live, or where people who aren't unhoused live. I don't want to suggest that only the people, because I obviously am very upset by this part of it, because to me, people who are unhoused because of poverty, mental illness, drug addiction, whatever reason that it is, to me, these are the people we should care about the most, not the least. And the idea that we are taking what life they have and destroying it, and putting them in, you know, questionable, whatever, wherever they're going to put them, which I can't imagine is going to be a place that they would consent to outside of this action, is very troubling to me. So it's not just kind of our general idea of liberty. It has very specific liberty implications for a particular class of folks. And they are the folks who, in many cases, have the least amongst us. And so that's, you know, very, very upsetting to me and very troubling.
What can people do?
Well, I mean, there's a large, I think, panoply of things that you can choose from. And I think the important thing is to find out or to figure out what you feel comfortable doing and do that. A lot of times people will say, look, you know, here's the answer, do this. There is no answer. There's no one answer. And anything I say is probably tied to what I do, you know, but there's a large range of responses. And I think the first and easiest thing to do is to find other people who are concerned in your area and start to work with them to figure out what in your area you can do, you know, because I think everything always starts at some level, you know, in the neighborhoods where you're at, and finding other people like you who are interested in the same thing, who are going to work together to organize to change the area where you are. You know, that can then build to something that's statewide, or it can build to something that's nationwide, or you can connect with other people in other localities and other states and things like that. And I know none of that sounds like an easy, here's something you can do, but I do think it's important, and I really believe this, to find the people proximate to you who are doing work in this area and getting together with them. It makes things a lot easier when you have a group of people and you're working together. You know, I tell the story, there's a group in Michigan that, you know, for years, this group of, they're basically people who were parents whose kids were incarcerated, and they met each other at a support group, and they started to make it more of a political group, and they started going to the Capitol, you know, probably once a month. And there are multiple times where laws would have been worse, or where laws didn't pass, or where good laws passed, because these people spent years going to every single office once a month. This never fails, never stops, having these conversations with their legislators and things like that. And that can happen at the local level, that can happen at the state level, that can happen at the federal level. But having that group of people that supported each other through that and never stopped going, no matter how they showed up the first time and no one listened to them. The second time, no one listened to them. But because they were together, they could keep going, and they could keep going, and they could keep going, because they were giving each other strength.
That was my conversation with Josh Ho, Senior Policy Manager at Dream.org. For now, that's it. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Remember to help KBOO reach our $45,000 KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive goal by showing your support today at kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Every donation is appreciated. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
Peace, this is MF Grimm. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This feels like home being here. Keep hip-hop alive.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Hold up.
I'm Tunde Sizwe Shimaringa, and you're tuned to Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Network. We're looking at recent political wins that are reshaping New York. New York State Assemblymember Zohran Mamdani won the New York City Democratic mayoral primary in June of this year, and the push is on to derail his campaign. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, also known as FAIR, the national media watch group that has been offering well-documented criticism of media bias and censorship since 1986, ran an article on July 30th detailing how the Wall Street Journal ran 10 op-eds in 1 week, 10 in 1 week, attacking Mamdani. Then on August 4th, FAIR noted how media were blaming not current Mayor Eric Adams, but Mamdani for the mass shooting that occurred in New York City on July 28th when Shane Devon Tamura walked into an office building in Midtown Manhattan with an assault rifle and shot and killed 4 people, seriously wounded 1 other person, and then killed himself. Mamdani had been out of the country at the time of the shooting. Most recently, former President Barack Obama has phoned Mamdani, and although we don't know what they talked about, some folks are worried about that. The reason some folks are worried about that is because they say, and I'll tell you who they are in a minute, or should I say, it has been said that the Democratic Party is where movements go to die. I wanted to explore that further with my guest today, Dylan Rodriguez, who is the distinguished professor in the Department of Black Study and the Department of Media and Cultural Studies, and he was previously in the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Dylan, thank you so much for being on Hard Knock Radio today.
They do not know what they did putting Tunde Sizwe Chimurenga in charge of this airwave right here. It is an honor as always. It is an honor as always to be on your show, Tandy. For people listening to this,
show, we go, Dylan.
Yo, no. Today it is.
Hard Knocks Radio. I'm sitting in for
it. It is Hard Knocks Radio. all, hey, Davey D, respect, Hard Knocks Radio, respect. I grew up, I literally grew up with Hard Knocks Radio in the 90s. Like when I lived in the Bay Area from 95 to 2001, Hard Knocks Radio was it. Still is it. But today I just want people out there to know I go back 25 plus years with Tondi Chimurenga, and it is an honor as always to be on the air with you to talk about some things that are crucial to demystifying the way some of our earnest, serious, and principled people might be misled, might be misinformed, might be miseducated. This is a principal point of conversation. I'm glad that you started this off and invited me on to talk about it.
Sounded like Malcolm X, been had, took, and misled. Is that what you're saying?
Real. I mean, that's the least of it, right? I mean, that was when Malcolm would say that, that was always a precursor to, you know, a 45-minute to hour and a half lecture where he would get down into details. He'd produce historical receipts. He would think about some living archives, and he would hash out an argument. So, you know, like, I want to make sure that we understand that before there was such a thing as a soundbite, Malcolm X was already introducing the whole concept of counter propaganda against liberal and right wing propaganda, and that was just an invitation. So when Malcolm X would say stuff like that, that was an invitation. That was an invitation to come in and join him for some study. So like I, you know, I think all of us should be doing our best to try to work and think within the tradition of Malcolm X for sure. Just like you said.
So at least 60 years ago, and that would be 1965. So at minimum 65 years ago, Malcolm X told us about the fox and the wolf, the Democrats and the Republicans. They were both canines. They were both predators. One bared his teeth. The other one was slick. But again, they're both predators. They're both canines. They are both stalking black people. The Democratic Party being the place where movements go to die. You said that's what, the tip of the iceberg? Is that what you said?
No, I said, I wish it was that. I wish it was that benign.
Okay.
It's so much worse than that. It's so much worse than that.
Okay. Well, talk to our audience.
And I appreciate that. You know, I appreciate the fact that you started us out with Malcolm X. You know, we're in Black August, and you know, we're still fighting the struggle around political unrecognized U.S. political prisoners and prisoners of war, Black liberation struggle. So Malcolm X is a fitting way to kind of stay. Let's kind of stay with Malcolm X here and thinking about his political analogy. You know, of particularly of the fox, because another way to think about that lesson, you know, maybe starting from around 1960, 1965. So let's think about this last 60 or so years. And let's fix our attention on the Democratic Party. You know, a lot of people listening to this are probably familiar with the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, what the FBI undertook, you know, during the middle part of the 20th century into the late part of the 20th century to infiltrate, undermine, and destroy radical revolutionary and liberation movements in the United States, internal to the United States, right? From Black liberationists, Puerto Rican independentistas, the anti-war movement, you know, even the liberal progressive arms of the civil rights movement. So people are familiar with the counterintelligence program and the role of the FBI. That's the form of what we could call domestic counterinsurgency that I think a lot of politically educated and activated people are relatively familiar with. What I think folks are still struggling to learn about collectively is this other dimension of domestic counterinsurgency that is precisely what Malcolm X was gesturing toward when he talked about the fox in the hen house. And that's principally, it's a combination of the Democratic Party, generally in concert and coordination with the rise of what's come to be known, and which is particularly relevant in the Bay Area, as the nonprofit industrial complex. So when we think about what the Democratic Party did around the period of time that you're talking about here, when we think about the Democratic Party playing a very specific role, an important role, in building domestic warfare around a certain phase of counterinsurgency, we got to understand what counterinsurgency is. You know, I think that there is oftentimes an assumption that when we use a term like counterinsurgency, we're primarily or maybe exclusively talking about violent, repressive police and state activity against Black liberation and other liberation movements, other radical and revolutionary and anti-colonial movements. That's one part of counterinsurgency. At its heart, what counterinsurgency actually is, it's about defending and or reassembling the legitimacy of state power. That's what it's actually about. It's a war over legitimacy, y'all, right? It's not just a war to repress radicals and revolutionaries. It's a war to rescue the legitimacy of the existing power structure, okay? And this is what Malcolm was talking about when he introduced us to this parable of the fox, right? The Democratic Party has built and expanded its role alongside the nonprofit industrial complex, such that it's extended its tentacles into almost every imaginable realm of politics and culture to do what? Well, so the primary thing it is interested in is precisely that primary and foundational aim of counterinsurgency, to defend, to reassemble, and sometimes to reform state power so it can win back legitimacy among those very people who may be in active insurrection against it. Okay, so it's about the legitimacy of existing state power and the legitimacy of an existing political economic order, in this case, racial capitalism. So the Democrat, when we think about the Democratic Party, it's not just where movements go to die, right? It's not just, so that assumes the Democratic Party just sitting still. The Democratic Party is activated. They are sending people into movements to recruit operatives, right? To recruit people who will run for elected office. This happened with the Black Panther Party. It happened all over the place, right? So when we think about the Democratic Party, it's quite active, it's quite mobilized, and it actively seeks to wage counterinsurgency warfare in a kind of liberal progressive, you know, in a liberal progressive kind of cosplay, by way of, oftentimes by way of appropriating, that is stealing, the language and ideas that radical and revolutionary movements have constructed, right? Whether it's abolition, whether it's decolonization, whether it's radical trans justice, whether it's something, whether it's disability justice, whether it's something else. This is what the Democratic Party has been doing in a really intensive way for the last six decades. And the last thing I'll say on this point, the Democratic Party does not only steal language and ideas, it steals people, right? Like, we could go through a roster of people who got their training, their political education, who frankly were radicalized. And I mean radicalized not in the right-wing sense. I mean radicalized in a liberatory sense, right? Radicalized as radical feminists, as radical abolitionists, as anti-colonialists, in collective grassroots organizations, collectives, and movements. And oftentimes, this apparatus, this combination of the Democratic Party and the nonprofit apparatus, they will actively recruit some of the most promising and smart people from these generally, oftentimes, autonomous, grassroots, community-based collectives, and try to incorporate them into their own apparatuses. And those folks end up doing the work of legitimation. And so that's what we're talking about. When we're following the lesson of Malcolm X, I would argue that this is an important part of what he was teaching us shortly before he himself was assassinated and neutralized, although never fully destroyed, right? Never fully destroyed, because Presente, right? Never fully destroyed by the counterintelligence program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about Malcolm X, but what you said makes me think about another soldier, another warrior for our people, another warrior against oppression who we exalt during the month of Black August, George Jackson, in Blood in My Eye, when he asks a question. He says, prestige bars any serious attack on power. Do people attack a thing they consider with awe, with a sense of its legitimacy? So you talked about counterinsurgency as the attempt of the state to reassert, regain, reclaim, recoup its legitimacy.
There was perhaps no more important figure in this hemisphere, intellectually, strategically, and theoretically, than George Jackson over this very same period that we're talking about, meaning the last about 60 to 65 or so years, ongoing 60 years, ongoing almost 70 years. And the reason I say that is because what George Jackson I think, understood in real time with dense, studied, theoretical seriousness were both sides of the counterinsurgency apparatus. The one side that he knew was out to destroy him, right? Mm-hmm. That he knew that he was on borrowed time, right? So he understood that part of counterinsurgency very well. That's why it is impossible to talk about George Jackson without simultaneously thinking about the long record of radical collective insurgency and insurrection that he cultivated in dense and studied ways with his incarcerated comrades and with so-called free world comrades. So he understood that part. At the same time, it's his work that I think has trained increasingly serious and militant collectives of people around the pitfalls of liberal and progressive state reform as the other side of counterinsurgency. And by and large, this has been pushed by the Democratic Party, and especially by progressive, so-called progressive Democratic Party operatives and interest groups. George Jackson understood that struggle over legitimacy was nothing short of warfare. And he understood that the liberation of colonized people, the liberation of Black people, the overthrow of an anti-Black and chattel and colonial civilization relied on waging successful counterwar against this genocidal anti-Black legitimacy that sits in the state, that sits in the existing political economic order. He understood that better than anybody. So I think that this is an entirely appropriate way to think about what we mean when we say, on the one hand, that maybe movements go to die with the Democratic Party, and on the other hand, the Democratic goes out and it seeks to actually appropriate, extract from, and neutralize movements as well.
So then what do we say to people like right now today who are up in arms over Trump? They are up in arms over Project 2025, up in arms over what ICE is doing. They've just been given billions and billions more dollars to run through the streets. They've got the alligator Alcatraz down there in Florida. What do we say to these folks who believe with all their heart that Kamala should have been the choice and that we've got to go Democratic the next time elections come around?
It's really important that we understand that liberalism is something like a religion. It oftentimes will morph from being a political position that you can actually engage and argue with into something that is closer, that more closely resembles, something like religious faith. In other instances, it might more closely resemble something like a political cult. Okay. And what I mean by that is the absolute state of denial that we are confronted with many of our loved ones and comrades, or maybe not comrades, right? I think it's actually important that we start telling people who might presume that they're our comrades, that they're not acting like our comrades, that they're actually acting like our enemies to the extent that they are invested in doing work alongside the state or with the electoral apparatus and with the Democratic Party, as you talk about it, Tandi. The denial that a lot of our folks are in is around the fact of the collapse. When we think about something like the emergence of Donald Trump's candidacy in 2016, right? So let's go to the first candidacy. That was primary evidence of the ongoing implosion of the United States, right? As a global empire, for sure. At bare minimum, it's the implosion of the United States as a global empire. Those days are limited. The only way in which it's holding on to it is a kind of flimsy grip on global political economy and a flimsy grip on a classical old school military, right? Project 2025, if you read the document, don't even read the whole thing. It's hundreds and hundreds of pages. Read the executive summary. Read the first 10 or 15 pages of Project 2025. What that document tells us is that the architects, the writers of Project 2025, they recognize that the United States of America is already fully in a period of collapse, and they are trying to take full advantage of it. Okay, that's what I think we got to tell our people, Tandi. Right, these right wingers, the people that we are now naming as fascists, right, people that even the liberals are naming as fascists, they fully recognize The period of collapse is already here. There's no point in trying to deny it. There's no point in trying to reassemble it. They are interested in assembling power around the collapse. Okay, and to the extent that too many of our loved ones are wannabe comrades, right, who might be acting like our enemies rather than more than they're acting like our comrades, to the extent that our folks or the people who think, the presume that they're our folks, are still invested in trying to rescue this existing electoral and state apparatus, they are 10 steps behind the architects of Project 2025. They are 10 steps behind the people who in the administrative state apparatus who have arranged for these asymmetric mass mobilizations of ICE agents, an expansion of ICE as a domestic war apparatus, as both to do what it's doing, which is to terrorize, right? It's to actually actively inflict, you know, semi-legitimated and semi absurd and gratuitous and deeply self-discrediting forms of state terror. Right, it's an experiment. Right, what Project 2025 tells us is that when you're in a period of collapse, what the most fascistic and authoritarian elements of power will actively do is they will engage in the most apparently spectacular and absurd and terroristic forms of power as an experiment to test what the boundaries of legitimacy actually are, because the state form, because the political economy, because the nation is already in a period of collapse. So frankly, I think we need to communicate to people is that they gotta stop believing in the American project. Mm. They gotta stop believing in that. They gotta acknowledge what George was already anticipating, George Jackson was already anticipating as he wrote Blood in My Eye. He was already observing the initial phase of collapse that we are talking about here. And by the way, when I say collapse, I don't just mean the political economy. I don't just mean the electoral apparatus and the Democratic Party. I'm talking about climate collapse, right? The folks that are listening to us right now, we live in California. California is exhibit A of climate collapse as it is manifesting in the United States. There is no going back. There is no going back to California being free of wildfires, free of energy grid collapse, free of in significant parts of California, like where we live, drought, you know, the preciousness and the constant denial and lack of water, of access to potable water. There's no going back. So when we talk about collapse, the evidence is all around us. And I think we frankly just need to start talking in real terms with our people, that especially those that we love, that we care about, that they gotta understand, they gotta embrace the fact that we are living in collapse, and we gotta come up with different strategies to build power in ways that will resist authoritarian administrative power, that will resist state terror, and will not force us to rely on that very same state to survive the collapse, and for that matter, to thrive in the collapse, because I don't think it's a sad thing that the U.S. is collapsing.
I'm speaking with Dylan Rodriguez, distinguished professor in the Department of Black Study and the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. We were talking about the Democratic Party and how it is where movements go to die. We got into a bunch of stuff, but I saw a piece on Instagram. You keep alluding to it. I need you to spell it out. There was a clip of you on Instagram which talked about literally the murderous hand of the Democratic Party. Not democratic principles, but the Democratic Party and their murderous hand in, you know, not being the place where the movements go to die, but actually killing the movements. And I mean, I want to go back to that.
I got to be honest with you, Tandy. I don't know the clip you're talking about, but I'm glad it's out there. I'm glad somebody caught me saying that, because I do mean it. I do mean it. I could have meant many different things by that. But you know, the Democratic Party is, so let me make sure that folks understand this. The Democratic Party is an internally complex institution. There are many different kinds of political positions within the Democratic Party. People argue with each other, they hate each other, they support each other, they fund each other, okay. At the same time, the Democratic Party nonetheless is a ruling totality. There's no denying that. It is a coherent ruling establishment. And its complexity is actually what makes it so powerful. Because within its complexity, you know, that apparatus, the Democratic Party apparatus, it will provide you, Brandon Johnson in Chicago, will provide you, our mayoral candidate in New York City, Mamdani, right? It'll provide you, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, so-called AOC. It'll provide you the so-called squad. It'll provide you former Representative Cori Bush, right? So it'll provide those things. And if we take a step back and understand the significance of figures like this, when we put aside for a moment, for the sake of argument, when we put aside what might be substantial differences in their policy positions, right? As minoritized as those policy positions might be, right? And as much as we might admire and support those policy positions, and I do, okay? And I do support those policy positions. But if we put that aside for just a moment, what we also have to understand is that the Democratic Party's willingness to tolerate these figures, including Bernie Sanders, right, during the presidential election in 2016, right, the willingness to tolerate these left liberal, left progressive, pseudo socialist type figures, is entirely in the service of legitimating the capacity of the state to absorb those who we would impute with radical positions. And let's be really clear here. The folks I'm talking about, they might have held radical positions prior to becoming elected officials. Okay, I don't doubt that. Right? I know people who know those folks, right? And they will testify to that all day, how radical they were at a certain period of time when they were organizers in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And will defend the fact that as soon as they became invested in the electoral system, as soon as they became candidates for elected office and therefore had to join the Democratic Party, had to put all that stuff aside. That's a given, right? So when we talk about the murderous hand of the Democratic Party kills politics. It kills who people are. It turns them into some other kind of deformed, respectable, you know, business suit wearing version of themselves that talks proper and doesn't cuss anymore, just like you told me not to cuss when I came on your show today. Right. So I'm doing my best impression of what I'd be like if I was in the Democratic Party today.
Oh my God.
Live there, and the FTC is here looking at us. So yeah, I got you. So this is what but this is what we're talking about. The Democratic Party. And so not only does it siphon off and neutralize people who are smart, who have radical positions, who are effective organizers, you know, like it does this all the time. Look what happened during and after 2020, the insurrections of 2020, in which people all over the planet, okay, not just in the U.S., all over the planet, in various ways were questioning, if not directly and militantly opposing, the legitimacy of police power at minimum. A lot of people were actually beginning to question the legitimacy of state power as a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout 2020. This is undeniable, right? This is what people were in this, like we were there. Tandy, like I know we were in different parts of this place watching and listening and talking and thinking alongside people who were asking these serious questions, questioning the legitimacy of the state. And I think it is crucial to pay close attention to the work the Democratic Party did alongside the liberal and progressive arms of the nonprofit industrial complex to pacify, to neutralize, to absorb, and for that matter, to institutionally empower certain elements of the uprisings during and beyond 2020 against state power, to reintegrate them into conversations and participation in the state. So that's murderous. That's murderous. That's killing who people are. That is killing the capacity to build autonomous forms of knowledge, of power, and of strategy. And thankfully, I will say I'm not here to be doom and gloom about it, because I'm here, I'm alive, I'm thriving with this, and I'm thinking with you about this, because there are proliferating communities of people who are continuing to insist on doing precisely that, which is to refuse the murderous hand of the Democratic Party, to refuse state power. And I think it's people who recognize that we are already in a period of collapse, right? And we have no choice. We have no choice but to be engaged in these conversations, these forms of collectivity, which may or may not involve organizations, right? They might just involve collectives, thinking experimentally. Some people have been calling it mutual aid. Right, I think that's the tip of the self-determined autonomous iceberg is what people have become started calling mutual aid in a kind of solid radical solidarity liberations and abolitionist sense.
That's the voice of Dylan Rodriguez, distinguished professor in the Department of Black Study, the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Today on Hard Knock Radio, we have been discussing the murderous hand of the Democratic Party. We've been discussing the legitimacy and the illegitimacy of the state. Dylan, for listeners who want to read more of your writings or hear more of your discussions, how can they keep up with you?
Hit me on email. That's one way. DylanRodriguez.collective@gmail.com. I guess you could hit me on Instagram. It's just, I think it's at DylanRodriguez73. But if you go to my Instagram page, there should be a link tree on there where folks should be able to access a bunch of stuff for free. But more importantly, just reach out, because I want to be in community with people. I mean, this is all that matters, Tandy. That's all that matters. So yes, I'd really be honored to be invited into community with people in whatever way I can be useful to helping cohere and build and strengthen community. Please invite me.
Thank you so much, Dylan, for your time. Thank you for your work, your example. Thank you for being on Hard Knock Radio today.
I love you, Tandy. Want to make sure I say that.
I love you too, brother.
All right.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else is just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Feel me. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kind of crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every knob is stick they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Ain't nothing made, they beats trying to eat till it ain't from the steel gray beef. Say please. Maybe it'll save you a seat at the table with a great red man. Say peace to their lovers, I name with a please. Make a stone shade on your name in the street. Let's go, David
G. Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast. Radio.
We remember Carolina Saldana, who helped spread news of our movement here in America to her brothers and sisters in Mexico. But she also brought news to us of struggles of the poor, the oppressed, the indigenous community, the working people of Mexico, and of her many stories that she shared with us. None is more chilling in her work on Ayotzinapa, where the state, using criminal elements, massacred over 40 students and young people who were trying to be teachers to educate indigenous and poor communities in Mexico. These people were disappeared because of their political beliefs. They were disappeared because they were young activists trying to make a better impact on their communities in Mexico. And Carolina brought those stories to us. She told us not only what happened, but why. And she explained and named many of the students who, to this day, many of their bodies have not been found. When we first heard about it, we were dumbfounded. We could not believe it, but we had to. The facts were the facts. And we live in an age of neoliberalism where governments can do anything and get away with it. She was brave. She was courageous. She spoke truths of power, and she told the stories of her community and other communities all around America. She told Mexicans about the Black liberation struggle, about Black August, the month of resistance, remembered for well over a century in America and the Americas. She told our story of struggle against police violence and prison violence and repression in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania and throughout America. Carolina Saldana will never be forgotten. We remember her, we salute her, we think of her, and we remember her spirit. We thank her for the gift of her presence in this world, in Mexico, and in the hearts of many people in Black America. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The rain falls hard. An old man sleeps, no roof, no guard. Under the freeway, lost in cold. Somebody's father left out alone. What mother could picture this sight? Her child forgotten, lost to the night. $1 billion homes lying the way, but for him there's no shelter, no place to stay. What happens to us when we fall from grace?
Fall from grace.
When the world turns its back. Why do the evil people never ever die?
Die.
While the good ones suffer and ask the sky,
sky.
Is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive?
Die.
As this old man shivers in the dead of night,
die.
Rich people passing their lives full of light, they turn a blind eye, too busy to care, while he's left to freeze in the cold, cold air. Why do the evil people never ever die?
Die.
While the good ones suffer and ask the sky,
sky.
Is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive? Why do evil people keep on living? Why so many who are good keep forgiving? One day, someday, things got to change. We can't keep suffering. We can't remain the same.
Welcome to PNN, Poet People's Revolutionary Radio. This is Jay, your co-host, formerly Houseless, youth poverty scholar, and in the studio with Poet and formerly Houseless poverty scholar, Mutiaro. On today's Poor People's Radio, we welcome in Comrade and Poor Magazine Extended Family Minister King A, working to liberate the cages in Ameri Klan.
Hey, what's up? What's up, Mr. King? How you doing? Welcome back to Poor People's Radio. Can you start by just telling listeners who do not know the powerful work that you have been doing since you got out of the razor wire plantation in terms of liberating elders, but also just liberating all of us from these cages?
Free the land. So my name is Minister King X. I'm formerly incarcerated. I did over 18 years in the state gallows, and I did 6 years in the feds and the caste system. During that time, while I was the youngest New African to help organize a hunger strike to end long-term solitary confinement. And during that time, we came up with a campaign not only to liberate our elders, but to end hostilities inside and out. And I stuck to that agreement. And now I'm out here fighting and building with other organizations, other individuals, and most of all my brothers and sisters, my comrades here in Poor Magazine.
One of the things that you've been working on, of course, in addition to just spreading awareness and constantly fighting the system, is to make sure that the voices of these elders who've been in these plantations are heard. I hear you got a book project that you're supporting with Elder Lewis Powell. Can you tell listeners and viewers about that?
Yeah, so Elder Lewis Powell, he's one of the principal thinkers who was part of the Oscar versus Governor settlement. He was in solitary confinement in Pelican Bay for decades, subjected to sleep deprivation, decades of minicide. I say minicide because their goal was not only to subject them to torture and elder abuse, but when they came back into general population, it was a lot of youngsters, a lot of the younger generations didn't have the education, didn't have the wisdom. So that was done deliberately. And a lot of the elders was punished for educating themselves and their groups and for having books like Blood in My Eye by George Jackson, Soledad Brothers. So during after the settlement, they let everybody out from one structure to the next, from solitary confinement to general population. And Lewis Powell began to create his memoir, his story. And his story, when we think about racial injustice, we want to put a face on it now. Born Without Justice by Lewis C. Powell. The truth about this book is it's the life story of a Compton street soldier. Lewis Powell is a principal thinker who educated himself and others alike. So when he come out here, we want to make sure that he got adequate resources and he not also subjected to economical violence, because in his particular class, those of our struggle, sometimes people think that we're a little too robust or unapproachable, so we don't find ourselves as formerly incarcerated people with all the resources, when we already have a blueprint of how to combat the hostilities and violence in the community. So his book, Born Without Justice, I'm gonna read this back part. He said, "I trust you have found some enlightenment in reading Born Without Justice. It is an unfinished story of a Compton, California street soldier. This book is dedicated to today's generation of street soldiers fighting behind enemy lines. This mission of the street soldier is in the struggle of freedom, justice, and equality. In the midst of adversity and ignorance, the street soldier would stand the test of time and would stand up for family, community fiercely, standing tall through it all. Your freedom is at hand. Dare to struggle, dare to win."
So the concept, he's organizing from the inside. And I think that some people don't understand or overstand that just because these plantations are holding us in those cages, that doesn't mean that we're not organizing. Can you explain to listeners what organizing from the inside means?
I'm glad you asked me that, because I always tell people the movement building inside is totally different than the movement building outside. So the movement building that they chose to do inside was under the guise of rehabilitation, under the guise of public safety. When we think about this historical document, the agreement to end all hostilities, that document was signed by a multicultural group, a multiracial, multigenerational group. And what it done, it established a relationship across racial and cultural lines and began to have conversations how we could go back and rebuild our community. because the agreement to end hostility is something that we could utilize in the street with these principal thinkers, even the men and women of influence. Right now, what we're doing, we're actually creating a AEH street agreement. AEH is short for agreement to end hostility. So the street agreement will basically be a training manual to train the youth how to deal with economical issues, financial literacy, a replacement for the things that they engage in, even if it's underground activity. So this is just some of the movement building that we're doing.
Of course, everybody of our conscious listeners know that the prison industrial complex and its sick system, it makes bank on our backs. And the fact that elders like Lewis Powell and all of y'all do, again, resist inside of those systems where they would rather you be silenced, I think is very important and key piece to bring up. Also, publishing a book and making sure that your words and your work is outside of that plantation. But when you talk about economic situation, let's not get it twisted. One of the things that Poor Magazine Research has done a lot of work on, something like 40% of relatives who are on the street are formerly incarcerated. We know that those systems are there to break down our economics and force us to be in a subservient or a position where we are going into the underground strategy just to survive. So I'm curious, just in terms of that economic piece, how are you teaching folks the things that us poor people and people of color never get, which is how to budget? What kind of things do you deal with in that?
You have these formerly incarcerated people coming out, being subjected to being unhoused, being subjected to poor education, inadequate health care.
This is Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my